I'm going to call taxes to order. We want to finish up the governor's bill before we get to the Capco bill. And that was, at the last time, we had four or five people still wanting to testify on the governor's bill. So if you still want to do that and you're here, please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm here today on behalf of Life Science Alley, a trade association representing 600 companies here in Minnesota that work in life sciences, and we are here today to support that portion of the governor's budget and several other bills related to the Angel Investment Tax Credit. As the chair has reminded me, this is a bill that has been heard numerous times, and we don't need to go into details and try and elongate the process. But we have a little different situation this year, and I think members are aware of it. But not only is the bill something that's being brought forward by Representative Dabney here in the House, but it's also part of the governor's budget. And we've been working quite hard, not only with the administration, but also with the authors of the bill and the chair of the committee and staff, to try and draft something that's agreeable. We are very pleased with the progress that we're making on this, and I won't go into all of those details, but we are strongly supportive of this issue. You've seen in the press over the last few weeks a number of articles related to what's going on in other states near our borders in terms of credits that we are competing against, and we believe that this is something where we can't unilaterally disarm as things are going on in our border states that are going to impact our tax system. So we appreciate the chair's indulgence in working with us on these issues, and won't prolong the issue today other than to say that we also understand the difficulty that the legislature faces in trying to find revenue to fund this type of thing, and we hope that we can work with you to find a source for this tax credit. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I can go into more detail if you want, but I know that we will have hearings, and we have already had a couple of hearings on this issue, and I won't prolong that until we get to looking at the specifics on the bill here in the next few weeks. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Questions for Mr. Griffin? Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'm always interested in the background of the people who testify, and what's your background relative to the legislature?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I began my career as a staff assistant to Governor Rudy Perpich in 1976, and then had the opportunity to come to the Minnesota House of Representatives at a time when we had a very unusual situation. And I worked for Representative Ken Zube from Rochester for one session, who was the chair of the Higher Ed Division, who was then replaced by a representative from the western suburbs by the name of Lyndon Carlson, and I served under him, where I received the bulk of my training and knowledge here in the legislative process.
Representative Carlson.
I said with the legislature, I didn't necessarily mean all the way back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
He's a very good committee administrator.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Further testimony on the governor's budget. Tax pieces. Is there anyone else? Okay, if not, we're going to move on, and we're going to be, that's kind of the end of hearing the governor's budget. We do want to, do we have more bills in Capco? Just the Capco bill. Is Representative Winkler in the room? I think I gave him the wrong information. He just saw me and asked me, are you going to do the governor's bill for a little while? And I said yes, and then nobody wanted to testify. So maybe we can send a page to go find Representative Winkler, who mentioned that he was in a caucus of some sort, and that probably tells us nothing. There's one item we could do.
The minutes?
No, we could do the minutes if there's minutes, sure. Representative Garner, are you moving the minutes?
Certainly, Madam Chair.
So Representative Garner moves the minutes of the first, second, and third. Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Minutes are adopted. I guess we just wait for Representative Winkler.
We should have had some discussion.
I don't know where. Does anybody want to tell a story?
I have a story about Representative Coles. I can't tell it. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't know. I guess we'll just recess till we see Representative Winkler. We are in recess.
Time is everything.
They do that, please.
Yeah, do you do that?
No, I don't.
Oh, well,
And they're usually a satirist.
I won't be a lawyer again, so I won't.
Is that about? Yeah.
I won't find out, you know, until the 15th.
15th of?
Tax day.
Oh, well, when are they doing this? Holy shit, they do it.
Here he comes, big man.
Trying to raise money for you by now. They're very. Oh, really? But they're usually very esoteric and not very good for the regular practice. Usually the most practical ones are put on the CLT.
It's going to be the liberal policy.
Some of the handlers are
I mean, in a good way.
Well, you know, I went to stamp.
Divorce?
Oh, yeah. It's one of the things. They were rewriting the rules of divorce. The divorce law. The rules.
They are?
That's what they did. Yeah, they had practitioners there.
Now, you see, is this put on by the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers? Oh, okay. Is that, what's his name? He's got a lot. Fairly short guy.
Winkler.
I don't.
Alabama. Can we write Alabama?
You have fans.
Jasper, Alabama. Sweet home.
Oh, justice.
This is white powder.
Breathe deep.
Don't say pork out there. It was deep fried.
My best friend.
I didn't know there was such a
thing.
Leaching in Indiana. Birmingham, Alabama.
I quit practicing family law because I could stand it. It's lucrative.
I thought I was telling you I'm set at time here and I'm early. How about that?
We're in recess.
We started in recess. Oh, you did? Oh, what was your recess for?
No.
Want to go out and play or go?
No, he wanted to be on that. She voted for that. Which tied our, that's why we couldn't do the built one.
I have no idea.
Really good.
Oh,
really
good.
Like my
second
very good.
That's
all right.
Yes, I did. You watched?
Yes.
Why are we waiting?
Thanks. Oh, who did we put on? I can't remember who we put on.
We're waiting for
you.
We
need to put straw over here. Not straw. Like one.
Yeah.
Do you know we're at recess, we're waiting for Ryan.
Right?
What? We're at recess, we're waiting for Ryan.
She's giving
me
the
wire off.
And for what?
You got to have people that can go.
I'm going to call the tax committee back to order. Representative Winkler, I apologize if I told you in the elevator I thought you'd have a little time, but I was wrong, and so we're coming back out of recess to hear Representative Winkler's bill. Representative Winkler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm actually glad that you sent Sarah up because I was able to clarify what you've discussed in the committee so far about this bill and what you haven't. We have had a hearing, I believe it was last session, on House File 2770 or a bill very similar, the Capco proposal. And this is, I think, as you know, in the governor's budget, and it is something that's been done many places in the country, sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully. Essentially, the way this bill works is that you create an incentive, tax incentive, for insurance companies to take a portion of their reserves and invest it in venture capital funds that do business in Minnesota and seek to find investment deals in companies that meet certain criteria that are substantially similar to the angel investor type companies, except that the big difference really is that these are later stage capital company or later stage development companies with different capital needs than startup companies that need angel funding just to get off the ground at the very beginning. Madam Chair, I think this is somewhat familiar ground to members of your committee, and because of that, I wanted to address a couple of the issues that were raised by Joel Michael in his tax incentives and venture capital financing report that you asked for, which I think, you know, for the most part is a it's a very good report. Although it's a little bit not exactly on point for Capco, because the Capco or Minnesota Business Investment Act is not necessarily a Minnesota versus Wisconsin kind of bill. And frankly, I agree with a lot of the people who say that we shouldn't spend all our time focusing on whether one particular business or businesses jump across the border into Wisconsin. We should be looking at the overall health of our economy in Minnesota and identifying places where the market's working or not working and try to improve those. And so this report, I think, heavily focuses on Minnesota versus Wisconsin, but there are some metrics contained in the report that I think are useful for demonstrating the value that Capco really provides. And I don't know if members have this with them or not, but I think that the primary point I would like to go to is that Minnesota does do very well versus Wisconsin on the total amount of venture capital dollars invested in the total number of deals done. And in fact, Minnesota, if you exclude California and Massachusetts, does slightly better than the national average on, again, the amount of the deals and or the number of the deals and the size. But I think there's an important point that is not included here that I think is worth bearing in mind. And that is that Minnesota, the large preponderance of deals, venture capital deals done in Minnesota, are in one industry. They're in the medical device or the med tech sector. And the data I have from the PricewaterhouseCoopers study, if you dig into it, in 2008 there were 49 venture deals done in Minnesota for a total of $477 million, which looks quite good. But the approach of the study was to exclude those kind of outlier states who get much more than their share, Massachusetts and California. Well, in Minnesota, if you took out one sector, MedTech, if you took out that one outlier of a sector, our performance is very different. And so of those 49 deals done in 2008 in Minnesota, 40 of them, 40 out of 49 were done in medical devices. And if you look at the non or the nine non-medical device deals, only four of the nine were in the post-angel funding less than $5 million category. So when you begin to dig into those numbers a little bit and look at where Minnesota is very strong and take that out as an outlier, if you will, and look compare the rest of Minnesota's venture capital funding, you'll see that actually we don't stack up very well. Now, again, this could be, other states may also have certain strong sectors, but I think the consistent testimony and discussion that I've heard, and if you go out and talk to venture capitalists, Minnesota is known as a medical device or a med tech state to the extent it's known in venture capital. And outside of that, pretty much it's non-existent. So I think that's a point that's important to note. One other point here. And the other thing that Mr. Michaels' report, I think, raises and is an important policy point and one that we should always remember when talking about tax credits is that you never know how much activity you're incenting that would have happened anyway. And I think it's the answer to that for this proposal is that these firms, these companies would not be investing in venture capital in Minnesota at all without this credit. And so the ability to actually change behavior and focus this capital into the venture area at this stage of funding, which is lacking in Minnesota, I think is very powerful. And there's a lot of discussion about the general value of doing tax credit type programs, but I think if you break down the numbers a little bit and look into it, venture capital in Minnesota is lacking outside of one sector, and this bill would be a very effective way of generating more investment dollars flowing into that section of the marketplace.
Thank you. So we want to take public testimony for and against this bill before we get to committee questions. We did have some folks who contacted us about speaking on this bill, so I don't know if they didn't come or is there anybody who would like to speak for or against this bill? Okay, last call. Oh, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ian Cox. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice. And we're a tax and research budget research organization here in Minnesota for been operating for 25 years. We have a concern. I'm speaking today on behalf of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice and the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And we would recommend to you that you not adopt this particular piece of legislation. A couple of reasons. We were quite persuaded by Joe Michaels' analysis that we have a very competitive investment capital base here in Minnesota, and that it is functioning well. We think that it's basically it ain't broken, so I'm not real sure why we need to fix it. A number of independent people have looked at Minnesota's capital formation capacities over the years, and they've all the main ones to look at are basically have rated as very high. The Milken Institute, the Corporation for Enterprise Development, and others basically said that's one of Minnesota's strengths. So the question before you, it seems to me, is in with limited resources and facing a situation where you're going to be very hard-pressed to meet your own basic responsibilities of meeting your obligations to the state in terms of adequate education, adequate health care, and other things, why shouldn't you focus your limited resources into doing those well and let the business community do what it does well, which is make good business decisions and good business judgments? So You don't really have these resources floating around. They're part of a larger package of the governor, and which would cost $800 million next when it's fully phased in, add to the deficit. So really, these are monies that you don't have in surplus. These are monies that would come out of because we're in a deficit situation. We're going to be there for a while. This $80 million would come out in lost revenue, in how it would affect the state. It would be an $80 million revenue loss down the road to the state at a time when you are very much pinched for resources. Well, if you have to cut $80 million out of your future budgets, those $80 million support jobs. They support professors at the University of Minnesota. They support teachers. They support indirectly firemen. They support transportation workers and the like. So if you think of the opportunity cost first, is you're going to have to cut maybe not a total of 80,000, but some fairly high fraction of that in jobs, first thing, and then hope that this $80 million diverted somewhere else will somehow or other produce jobs. Well, if it's going to produce jobs, it would have to first produce a number of jobs that are at least equivalent to the number of jobs you're cutting, and then it would have to produce jobs on top of that. So that's a challenge these kind of things happen. So there is a cost. There's a jobs cost to taking away from your future revenues. So we think that it wouldn't necessarily be good for the economy. About the structure of the program itself, we think it's not a well-conceived program. Basically, what happens is Minnesota puts up 80% of the dollars. The dollars get invested for a relatively short period of time, and after that investment period, the dollars aren't returned to Minnesota in terms of the principal coming back. They aren't returned to Minnesota in terms of any interest on the gains of these investments. No, they stay with the companies that you entrust this money to. So it's a bad deal. No business would ever enter into a venture of this type, because it's a bad investment in that regard. So we would urge you not to undertake it. Other states who have tried this, you've heard that some states have had, that it's been renewed in other states. I don't know if that's testimony to the good results or if it's testimony to the skill of the lobbyists in those states. Maybe one or the other, we don't know. But we do know that in a number of states, it has failed. And it has failed in a manner in which the public officials sing out to the heavens to have other states avoid going down this route. So we think you need to look at best examples from the other states, not failed examples. And we think this one does not meet that test. So that concludes the basic remarks, Madam Chair. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Is there any other public testimony? I'd like to get the public testimony done before I think Representative Winkler, the committee actually does not understand this bill very well, so we do want to go through the mechanics, but let's get the public testimony done first because we have a habit of leaving them out. So please, come, welcome.
Okay. Welcome, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Korngold. I'm the president of Enhanced Capital Partners, and my firm has participated in similar programs in other states around the country and has some experience that we can share. I also am a native Minnesotan and have long thought that this program would be perfect for Minnesota, because while Minnesota has had a great history of venture capital, those firms, if you look back at the strongest part of Minnesota's investment history, they don't exist anymore. And if they do, they don't invest in Minnesota anymore. They got big, they got successful, and they went to the coast. And that's actually a story that's repeated in other places as well. But what it's done is it's left a void, with the exception of the medical device sector, for capital for businesses that get beyond that initial angel financing, but desperately need capital to grow. And as we all know from the last 2 years that we've just lived through, that capital that used to be available from banks and other alternative lending sources, it does not exist. If you have a business, particularly outside the Twin Cities, and you need a small amount of money, and you do not have a sexy, high-tech business, you truly have no place to turn to grow your business. You need $750,000 to expand your plant. The sources just do not exist for that capital. And again, that's not just Minnesota. That's repeated throughout the country. This program started 15-odd years ago. And like a lot of programs, they got a lot right, and they got stuff that they didn't get right. And early audits revealed a lot of flaws, the chief of which it was too expensive, it put the state at too much risk, and it didn't have adequate aligned interests. But that was 15 years ago. And since then, 10 states have done this 28 times, and while I'd like to think that lobbyists are good, that the states that have reauthorized this time and time again, they're not doing so because of lobbyists. They're doing so because they're looking at their own data and their own successes, and they're choosing to put more and more capital into the program. So I recognize the limited resources that the legislature faces as well. The one thing I would say about this program as opposed to the other tax credit proposals that are before this legislature, number one, as Representative Winkler alluded to, you have 100% certainty that but for this tax credit, this capital would not go into small businesses. It hasn't historically. These insurance companies do not invest in non-admitted assets. Number two, the other problem with tax credits is frequently there's a budgetary impact before you get the behavior that's desired, whereas here, the behavior that's desired exists for several years before that first tax credit hits in 2014. And so I would suggest that in a time of limited resources, it's exactly that timing mismatch, getting the benefit today to create jobs in these small businesses that need capital to grow, with the offset coming in 2014 and then thereafter, is exactly why states are turning to this program. And I'd also be happy to answer any questions if that's helpful based on experience elsewhere as well.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Is there any other public testimony? Really don't want to have anyone who came and not be able to testify. There's no one else who wants to speak for or against this bill. Okay, great. So questions to the from the committee. Rep. Coles.
Madam Chair, I had a question for Mr. Cox, if he'd be willing to come back up to the table, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Sure, that's fine. Although I do want to make sure we have time to understand the mechanics of this bill, because Rep. Winkler, we did hear this bill, I believe, in 07, so that was a long time ago. And we heard it, I think, last year as part of the governor's proposal, but I recall it well, and it zipped through in about 3 minutes. And the House didn't support it, and it didn't get through the process, and then we had some conversations about it in conference committee, which, of course, these folks all didn't necessarily hear it, so I really do want to spend some time on the mechanics. Rep. Coles.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm happy to defer my question. It's a little bit more of a general question, but Mr. Cox, I guess I'm curious. I'd like to hear your reaction to either the premise behind Representative Winkler's bill or the testimony we just heard from the other gentleman about the insufficiency or the inability of companies outside of the medical device industry in Minnesota to obtain that the early stage, not the angel stage, but sort of the second stage capital as they're developing. Do you just disagree that that's not presently available? And if you do, what's your basis for that disagreement? And if you do agree that there's an issue there, how should, if not this, then what should we as a legislature be doing from a policy perspective to address that challenge that exists for small businesses that are trying to get going here in Minnesota?
Mr. Cox.
Well, I don't know that there is a gap. There may be a gap. I don't know one way or another. I haven't looked at the information in detail with respect to what we just heard. It may be that it would show a serious gap, or maybe that they're not. I don't know. So I can't give you an informed opinion about that. Let's say there is a gap. You can step in and attempt to do it. Let's say if you pass all the other hurdles. For instance, if you decided that, well, it's worth whatever jobs we're going to lose by diverting these public dollars from their otherwise purposes, and we're persuaded that somehow or other we can make those determinations better than the marketplace in terms of where investment ought to go. But basically, I'm pretty much of the opinion that the market, in the investment market in Minnesota is pretty smart. We have a very skilled investment market in Minnesota. And if they're passing on deals, I'm not really sure why the state of Minnesota thinks that it can have better wisdom than the market in that situation. Let me give you an example. Last year, one of the examples used to do this plan was a biomedical firm that used some technology that had been developed at the University of Minnesota. And the argument made then was that, this company went to Wisconsin because it didn't get the kind of capital it needed, this sort of mid-stage capital. And Wisconsin used Capco to do it. Well, that company's out of, that happened last year, that company's out of business now. It's a very risky thing to back venture capital. And I don't know that it's, that the government has a better handle on how to make those investments in the private market. So, if you think that they do, then you can do this thing. Let's say it passed all this test. This is not the way to do it, because this is the worst deal for Minnesota monetarily. The only reason other states have done this is because they get some upfront dollars. You get the free ride for a couple of years with the investments being made before you start losing the revenue from the insurance fees. But there's a smarter way to do that if you wanted to go that kind of a route. Here's what you would do. You would take those future revenues and monetize them, and then use that that revenue then up front, and then you would assign the responsibility of making the investments to somebody like the Minnesota State Investment Board. You could control, you could make sure that your guidelines were carefully followed, because it's the government doing it. And secondly, then after your seed capital succeeded and they were moved on to a higher stage, you would then sell your shares in the stock and then reinvest it. So you would retain all the money that you invested, you would retain the earnings you invested, and you would have a self-perpetuating fund. This doesn't do that. This money walks away from the state. I mean, literally walks away from the state, because the corporation promoting it are out-of-state corporations. And after a very few small term of investment, that money's gone. So keep it in the state. If you decide to do this, keep it in the state. Keep it under control. Make sure you retain the principal and you retain the investment.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Some calls.
Madam Chair, for Representative Winkler, I guess, and this gets into the mechanics of the bill, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, help me understand the state's role in managing these investments. As I understand, Mr. Cox believes that the state has a big role in managing the investment. That's the testimony I just heard. Maybe I didn't understand it correctly, but it was my understanding that we're creating a fund that insurance companies can claim a credit from if they invest through one of these Minnesota investment companies. Can you help me understand the mechanics of this? Because I didn't understand the proposal as Mr. Cox just described it. Help me out.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I don't think he was quite saying that. I think he was saying that there's $80 million of public money involved in creating the tax credit, and that if you're going to have $80 million of a public tax credit, maybe you should instead take it from your state board of investment and have them own, like, you know, equity in these companies. That's a different set of discussions. What this program does is not different, frankly, than a lot of other tax credits that we create, most of which I think are on dubious grounds. But what this program does is it creates an incentive for a person with capital or an entity with capital, an insurance company, large reserves. They have certain risk portfolio or risk profile that they have to meet. Included in that risk profile is a certain amount of high-risk venture deals or other kinds of, I suppose they could potentially do other sorts of things besides venture capital, but they have a certain percentage that goes to high-risk investments, and this creates an incentive for them to take that money that of that portfolio or that profile that's high-risk, put it into a fund that is managed by a venture capital company. And remember, a venture capital firm, all it does is take money from groups of people, from businesses or from pension funds or from individuals, They pool it together, and then they go out and do research and try to find the best possible deal for returning money, knowing that there's going to be a high rate of failure. And then the offset, obviously, is that there's a much bigger return when it's successful. So they create a venture capital fund using insurance reserve proceeds, and they invest it in certain qualified businesses in Minnesota. So what the state is paying for, what the state credit pays for, is for those insurance companies to direct a certain portion of their portfolio into certain types of Minnesota businesses. And again, the bill defines, essentially, what types of businesses can qualify. And the goal is to aim those investment dollars at companies that have received angel funding and are moving on and need up to $5 million to expand operations or to take their technology to the FDA or whatever it might be. And they're having trouble finding that. And the reason why I think this solves a problem is that what Mr. Korngold was talking about were companies outside the Twin Cities or companies outside of certain sectors that are well known. A lot of that money doesn't find a small company in Hutchinson if it's coming from venture funds from the coast. The reason you create the pool is so that they become more aware of those companies. They look for deals and they increase the total amount of money available for those deals. So yes, the investor community in Minnesota for venture deals might be a very wise and shrewd group of people, but if they have a limited amount of money that they're investing, they're going to pick the best deals, but that doesn't mean that a lot of other really good deals don't go by the wayside simply because the capital is not being directed their direction.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, does your proposal do anything to change the investment rules or investment guidelines that insurance companies are already required to, Department of Commerce limits what insurance companies can invest in, how much they can, how much they can invest in higher risk products, how their investment portfolio has to look generally. Does this change that at all, or does this? Can you help me out with that?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, this doesn't change the risk portfolio or risk profile of the reserves of insurance.
Yeah,
companies.
It would have to go to Commerce if it did. So, no. Any more?
No.
Okay. Other questions? And I do want to spend some time on mechanics before we have to adjourn here, because I really don't believe members understand this bill very well, because the House has not spent a lot of time on it. And so, Representative Winkler, you know that I have a different view on this bill as you do, but I want to first have people try to understand what it's doing in as an unbiased way possible first, before people kind of get into the fight about it. But I have to first challenge some testimony that's already been brought forward that, there's 100% guarantee that this wouldn't happen without this bill, or, this is new money. It might be new money flowing through an insurance company, but the capital market is the capital market. So, it isn't new money. I mean, you have to factor in displacement. If you're going to invest in here, then you're going to invest in capital less somewhere else. So, in that respect, I would just disagree with that, but I think maybe we're talking about a little different things. The tax committee has to look at this would be a taxpayer subsidy from the residents of Minnesota into the CAPCOs. And so for the mechanics to think this through, okay, so, for tax committee members, our tax committee members know that basically that the insurance premiums tax, which is the purview of this committee, works like a sales tax. And so they don't pay that. Consumers pay that. And it's called the retaliatory tax because that's how we design the sales tax around insurance companies in Minnesota. So that's the revenue stream that backs this concept is the sales tax, the retaliatory tax. So if the money, and Representative Winkler, correct me if anything I say now is wrong about this. Okay, so if this bill is passed, the money flows from the taxpayers into the insurance companies, who then, and backed through the sales tax, the retaliatory tax, who then would not take this risky proposition and therefore need to securitize or back the money first through treasury bonds. So they're not going to go out, the insurance companies themselves, and do these investments through the CAPCO until they have security that they're not going to be in trouble. So they require, as part of the way the bill is designed, unless the mechanics have changed from when I've read it, they require the Capcos to do all this securitization first and foremost so that the insurance companies don't take the risk because it's a risky venture. And then the Capco sells these investments to, you know, the little guy at the bottom, I guess, and the idea here, the goal of the bill, unless it's changed over time, is not to make safe investments. That's not what this is about. It is to take risky investments to get these, you know, big gains. And that's what we would want. I mean, if we were going to be the investors, we'd want to say, look, you know, you're going to strike out a few times, but you're going to hit some home runs. So we want folks to take these high-risk, high-growth strategies. But I think the way the bill has got the language in it, it requires that for the Capco to make money on the deal, they have to get all this money cycled through quickly in a very short amount of years. And most of these long-term risky sort of investments for capital venturists, you know, don't pay off quickly. So, you know, my estimation is that it requires much safer investments to take place than we would want to see in a venture capital strategy. And I think the way the bill is written is it requires Capco to make all their investments within 4 years, or they don't, 6 years, or they don't get their money, which, of course, why would they be here if they didn't want to get the money? So it's forcing the Capco companies, who are the kind of go-between here, to invest in money and turn it around quickly, or they're not going to get paid. So there's an incentive for the Capco companies to make money fast and maybe not take risky strategies, which is what we would want them to do. It's sort of counterintuitive. The insurance companies are fine in the deal here. They get taken care of because they insist before they go into work with the Capcos that they're going to cover their losses right out of the chute through Treasury bonds. And all of this, of course, is backed by the retaliatory tax. So there's a lot of tax issues in here that members really have to get their heads around. And I want to first give Representative Winkler the opportunity to refute stuff I've said, because maybe the mechanics have changed. There is, of course, there's another issue in the bill that this committee is familiar with, and of course, it isn't paid for. And we're going to try to not grow the deficit. But we're hearing yours because the government didn't pay for it either. So we wanted to be fair in that regard. But Representative Winkler, what did you see there? Any of your supporters who might want to refute any of that?
Madam Chair, I just have a couple of points. First of all, I can. It would take me about 5 minutes to go get a sheet of paper that shows where I could easily find the money to pay for the program if I thought that we were in an environment in which that was possible by simply eliminating other credits and loopholes of the tax code that don't provide any kind of productive outcome. So, yes, it doesn't. It's not paid for now. I think, you know, it's arguable, I suppose, that by investing the money now and paying for it later, it's sort of a stimulative impact. But I agree, it should be paid for. It should be paid for by eliminating dead weight in the tax code that's out there right now that's not doing anything. I have my suspicions that perhaps this is not the year to do something like that, however, and that's why the bill isn't drafted that way. Second of all, not all, far from it, not all venture capital deals are supposed to be long-term. Certain industries are very long-term. If you look, for example, at medical devices, the investment horizon is a long one because it takes a long time to develop the technology, to invent, you know, to do the research, invent the technology that that can be commercialized, go through government approval process, which is risky and takes a long time, and then the return, therefore, has to be much higher to make those deals worthwhile. But there's a lot of venture capital deals that certainly can fall within a six-year window and not be considered safer because they've happened in that time frame. Information technology deals can happen much faster because it doesn't take the market that long to react to your product once it's out there. So I guess the main point I would argue is that this creates a perverse incentive for venture capital to invest in safer deals simply because they have the capital companies have an interest in getting the money out there quickly. The mechanics of are in broad terms, I think, correct. But the point is that you're trying to increase the amount of investment dollars that are at the riskier stage of investment here. And if you compare, for example, the angel investor credit versus the Capco credit, there's actually significant data, I think, that indicates that Minnesota does not have a very strong venture capital segment outside of one sector. And that's because big money on the coast recognize that Minnesota in one sector is not a flyover state. In all other respects for venture capital, Minnesota is a flyover state. And I think that's why you do something like this to increase the total pool of dollars that are available for these earlier stage companies. And I think in the VC area, there's actually significant data to support that. I think in other areas, like in the early stage or angel investment, the data is not as strong.
Thank you. Did you want to add, Mr. I don't recall your name. I'm sorry,
Korngold.
Korngold, please.
I would echo just a couple of those points. You know, in our other programs in other states, like any investor, we're looking for a portfolio blend. And one of the wraps on the earliest Capco programs that, frankly, I thought was well-deserved was exactly what you were saying, Madam Chair, which was that the companies had an incentive to try to cycle money quickly. Those incentives not only have been removed, actually in the Minnesota bill, there's a penalty if you get your money back too quickly. You get a reduced credit. It's designed specifically with that criticism in mind. And if you actually look at the more recent programs, which are also not surprisingly the most successful programs, actually the portfolio blends are, we have equity investments in technology companies that have been growing for 7 years. We have shorter investments that have cycled back in 3 years. But in order to meet the milestones, and I think this is the key point, the bill requires that the fund has to be invested in 6 years. And that's roughly consistent with how a typical venture fund approaches it. A fund will typically invest in kind of that 6 or 7 year horizon. The difference is that capital funds can't take any profits from any successful investments until they've invested the entire fund. And so that incentive absolutely exists to invest as quickly as possible. But if the Capco doesn't make smart investments, then it's obviously been a colossal waste of the Capco's money as well, because the Capco has significant funds invested as well as the Capco's time. And I think it's that tension that has served to better align interests between the Capco and the state than, again, the earliest programs did.
Okay, so we have four people on the list. Representative Marquardt.
Cool. Madam Chair, what time are we adjourning today?
4:15.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, are we coming back to this tomorrow?
Not sure. We'll see how many questions there are.
All right, because I've got several comments. And
sure,
several
go
questions.
Ahead. Representative Coles, that's three.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, the main two things we're in this year's session for is to balance a budget and create jobs. And I haven't heard anyone talk about job creation. I heard of talking about how quickly we can invest money, and then I heard Mr. Korngold talk about the behavior desired. By looking at this bill, I don't know what the behavior is desired. And the problem with all of this is that, Madam Chair, you're exactly right. The goal of the legislation is to get the dollars out as quickly as possible. It doesn't guarantee one job. Nowhere in the legislation does it guarantee one job. It'd be like having a football game, and rather than saying the team that scores the most points going to win the game, it's a team that just gets the most plays off. Doesn't matter what type of player, if you even try to throw a touchdown strike. Just a matter of getting the numbers out there. And Madam Chair, the way it works, since the incentive even is in fact a quick pace, you know, 2 years you got to get 35% out, 3 years 50% of the investments out, 4 years 60%, it does create this incentive to get the dollars out quickly and get the paybacks quickly. And this is typically not your early risk, high growth type of jobs that you're going to. The second thing that the problem is, as the chair mentioned, is that let's say these Capcos are going to get the $80 million. They're required typically to put about 50% of it into a safe haven or treasury bonds. So you've got this $80 million. You've now taken $40 million of it out to put into a safe haven to make sure you can pay back the insurance company. So now you've got $40 million in this pool, but you still, to meet the requirements of the bill, you still have to invest $80 million. So you have to roll this $40 million over a few times within this short time frame.
This even more creates the incentive to do more loans. In fact, typically, the investments from Capcos, about 50% are loans rather than equity investments. And you will find out that this will require you to do more short-term loans. So if you're looking to create jobs, it really doesn't do that. And you don't have to take my word for it. The reason we didn't hear any jobs mentioned, because there aren't many created. There simply are not. If you look at any of the states and D.C. that have done state independent reviews, that means you're not going to use data that's been afforded by the four main Capcos, and that's Advantage Capital, Enhanced Capital, Stonehedge, and Wilshire. Those are the four main ones that have about 80 to 90% of all the business in all of these states. So that's another question to be asked. Well, you got four or five that dominate this. What you have here is none of them show good jobs. In fact, when I add it all up, you get about one job created, and I'm doing this a little bit liberally from the states that actually have done audited reports, you're getting about one job for every $500,000 spent. Which means out of this $80 million, if it's an average deal, you're going to create about 160 jobs. Now, this isn't, I mean, you can go onto the internet and find this stuff, and I'm sure they're going to have a response to this, but you've got to take a look at this. If we're going to spend $100 million, I mean, this is flawed, and you can go through everywhere here, and for example, they're going to give you some numbers for jobs. And yet, in many cases, the number of jobs are greatly overestimated. For example, in Texas, they credited, for example, in one business, 38 new jobs, when in fact the Capco investment was only 4% of the total investments. But then they counted Capco with every one of those jobs, even though it was only 4%. They've also, in Missouri, they counted part-time jobs. They had a lot of college students that were listed, but they counted those as full-time jobs. They looked at growth. There was an example in Texas with information that was given to me by Enhanced, actually. As I looked through there, there was one company called WebExcite or whatever that they credited like 68 new jobs in Texas. But the fact is the job had started in 2000, did not receive its first investment until 2006. And as I went back in the literature on this business, back in 02 and 04, they were already the second fastest growing company in Houston. But yet every one of those jobs, those 68 afterwards, were credited to Capco when they were growing anyway. And then there's always, when you look at jobs, what is the net impact? If we take $80 million here and get a certain amount of jobs, how many would have been created if we would have used the money in a different fashion? And so what I'm saying here is that when a lot of these states have taken out all of these overestimations, which are usually provided by these Capcos, it doesn't amount to much. And we're not seeing anything. And so if the idea is just to get the capital out there, okay, this will probably succeed in doing that. But it is inherently fraught with difficulties in creating jobs. It's just, in fact, there's disincentives to create jobs with this. And so I don't know how you correct it, but I members, if you're thinking about that this is a good deal, take a look at it, scrutinize it. Many of these states, Tennessee is the newest state to look at something right now, and they just did it back in November of 09. They purposely went away from what they said was the normal Capco model when they did this because of how bad it's been in other states. And that's, I think, one of the most recent ones, if not the most recent. And Enhanced, you're one of the six that were selected by the state.
Yeah.
The other five, they didn't go with any of the other normal Capco big four, if you will. So, members, you just got to take a close look at this. The way this is set up here is you're going to pump a lot of money out, and it's going to feel good for a while, but there simply is not the independent data to show that there is going to give you the job increase that you want, Madam Chair. And I guess I'd be willing to listen to a comment here.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I think that the number of jobs created is a measure that we should look at, but it isn't the only measure we should look at. in part because measures of jobs generally do not include a review of the long-term economic success of a state or a region or a country. And what you need to, I think, look at, in addition to jobs in the here and now, are the long-term economic consequences of having a segment of your market that is undercapitalized. The fact is that there's just, in fact, just today, there was a report released, I think, at the U of M's Carlson School that says that the most innovative companies are the ones that have funders, venture capital funders, with the greatest tolerance for risk. Now, it doesn't say anything about the number of jobs that are created by the most innovative companies, but the fact of the matter is that your economy in the long run is dependent on your productivity. That's what the state economist says, that's what the state demographer says, that the productivity of your workforce and the people in your state is what determines the success. And there's a lot of discussion also about small businesses and the jobs they create. That's true, but what you really need to look at is innovation. You have to look at where are new ideas coming from, where are new ideas being generated, and when old industries change or when they die out, do you have innovation coming along after that that's going to replace it? If we look at simply how to protect jobs, it's pretty easy. The state could spend $80 million and hire a bunch of people at $40,000 a year to do nothing or to do something that has little productive value. You have to look at the productivity of the dollars. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not Minnesota has a market problem in the amount of venture capital available, or whether we have a market problem with the amount of angel investor dollars available, or if we have other kinds of market problems out there. But the point is, our job is not to do a one-to-one look at how many jobs we can create or how many businesses from Wisconsin we can move over here. Our job is to look at the overall health of our state economy. I believe, and I am convinced, that innovative companies, startup companies, are in general in Minnesota lacking capital compared to other places, and that more capital for those companies would be better for the state's health in the long run than a program that creates jobs in the short run.
Madam Chair,
Representative Winkler, how are you going to measure success by this bill? What is in this bill that will somehow give us an outcome to measure?
Madam Chair, Representative Mark Ward, I think that what I would look at are the number of and the amount of venture capital funding deals that happen in Minnesota. And if you look at the typical company that is funded by venture capital, the companies are generally employing people with high levels of education, and they generally get very, very good wages. Now, again, this isn't going to be the answer to the jobs problem or the economic problem from top to bottom. This is targeting one part of the economic food chain that seems to be particularly weak in Minnesota. So I think the measure is how much venture capital are you bringing into the state, what segments of the market is it in, and how big are those deals?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Markhart.
Yeah, and I understand that. I just don't know if that's a good measure of success here. I think a lot of other ways we could do that. But we're concerned here about jobs, and I guess I have not heard from anyone yet where someone has given me in any state that this model has been used, and this is pretty boilerplate from what I can see. There's some changes, but it's pretty boilerplate. Where there has really been an independent audit that shows that it's been successful, or where a state has just given a glowing recommendation. I haven't seen it yet. Now, maybe I've seen studies that have been done by universities and that, but they've all, either the study has been aided by one of those four major CAPCOs, or the data has been provided by one of the four major CAPCOs. And again, that there's many, many errors with the job statistics there that many of the states have found. So I guess, is there a success story somewhere in a state that I can point to?
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Markhart, I think we've distributed this PowerPoint.
Yep.
And while those studies, some of the studies were actually funded by the industry, that was a requirement of program participation. And we, as the CAPCOs, did not, in most cases, provide that data. That data was actually provided directly by the companies that received the investment as part of their participation in the program. The most recent example of success that I would point to, because it's really the program on which the Minnesota bill is modeled, is Texas, and that is the comptroller's report. And I would advise you to talk to the Texas regulator. Again, not a third-party study funded by industry. Talk to the Texas regulator about their findings and what they believe they're getting in terms of job creation, because that was the reason that after passing a $200 million program in 2004, they came back 3 years later and added another $200 million to the program, because we didn't perform an independent study in Texas. They did their own study and analysis of that program.
Okay. Representative Marquardt and Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I could talk about the Texas results. They pumped in about $400 million total, $200 million initially, and then about four or five programs after that. And the latest I have is 555 new jobs. That came from that report. And again, you can look at this sheet right here. The Alabama study used the staff of Advantage, Enhanced, Stonehenge, and Waveland to conduct that. In Missouri, they had to respond to the Missouri audit, and so the study was co-sponsored, this is what you're getting here from, was co-sponsored by the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and the Growth Capital Alliance, which is a venture capital company out of St. Louis, Missouri. Wisconsin, the data there, even though it was University of Wisconsin study, was provided by Advantage, another one of the big four. And so what I'm saying is I have yet to see an independent government study that proves that this system's even close to working. In most places, it's called inefficient and too expensive. I'm not convinced, Madam Chair.
And we may need to go on because we have Gardner, Loeffler, Downey, and now I see Coles, Rukavina left, so we crossed him out. I do want to say, though, it would be interesting to see that data, and maybe Representative Winkler's idea here is the measure, because the stuff I've looked at, which is not funded by the industry, Florida, Louisiana, Missouri, New York, Texas, Wisconsin, have all done worse in the venture capital rankings since CAPCO came into existence. So if the idea is let's see where they were in venture capital after, worse. So I think this cries out for some independent analysis, but I want to get to Representative Gardner's question. I have to say, honestly, Representative Winkler knows that I've been frustrated with this. You know, the part that just slays me about all this, honestly, and it's not CAPCO, it's lots of stuff, is, you know, what happened to the free market capitalists? I'm a Democrat, but I believe in free markets. And Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand did not entertain public subsidies to CAPCOs. This is where I just get frustrated. I think some of the folks here who are the most free market capitalist pro-business people want to do these sort of government programs, and I'm just not convinced by them. And I asked Ms. Bergman if she could quickly find for the, not for Representative Winkler who was there, but for folks who were not there, the governor's state of the state, because I remember well what he said, and he said this year, so the most important question before us is this, how do we best grow good private sector jobs in Minnesota? The people who can best answer this question aren't in this room. It isn't us, you guys. Legislators are not good at this, and that's what we're doing, a bunch of legislators trying to figure out how to be capitalists. I mean, we can say we're assisting these other folks, but the truth is we're trying to be government bureaucracies who are trying to tell business people what to do, and we should just, you know, not be doing this, is my opinion. So to continue with the governor's quote, the people who can best answer that question aren't in this room. They're not in Congress. They're not in the White House. They're not in bureaucracies. In fact, they're usually not in government or politics at all. If the government listens to them, this is what it will hear loud and clear. Get out of our way. Leave us alone. Make it easier, not harder. This is definitely not getting out of the way. This is coming up with a new spending program for a part of the capital market. And so we've got a whole bunch of people who subscribe to the fact that they're free market capitalists and they should go back and read their Economics 101 textbook. And this certainly wouldn't be in that textbook. It would be the Invisible Hand. So it's not about you, Representative Winkler. It's just I have a real frustration with the folks who, with a straight face, not you, will say, you know, this is, let's let the free market work, but oh no, not really. And, you know, the governor, I mean, my frustration, honestly, is with him and people like him who will say that they are not playing in picking winners and losers. This bill absolutely does that. I mean, if it's just very frustrating because I kind of get, you know, a little it's a little, I get a little hit on by people on my side of the aisle because I'm more conservative in my party. And part of that is being a free market capitalist. And yet this, to me, comes often from the more conservative side, and I just don't honestly, I don't understand it. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I think your frustration is both palpable and justified to some degree, but I think your criticism is more about the political debate and the political rhetoric than it is about policy. Anybody who says that the market is always going to do good things is a fool, and anybody who thinks that government can always come in and provide a better answer is also a fool. And so our job is to attempt to sort through programs that actually benefit, provide some kind of, in this case, an economic benefit that helps the overall public interest, or a spending program in education or something else that helps the public interest. It's our job to sort through those, and so that's what I'm trying to do in discussing this legislation.
I agree with you. I just say that there is no, unlike the market, if this fails, there is no penalty like the market would do to folks, because they're still getting $80 million out of the people whether they make money or not. So it is not a free market. If they fail, the Minnesotans are left hanging. Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You kind of took the wind out of my sails there, but
jump in here.
But I guess my question is for the testifier also. I mean, should we be in the business of having a conservative industry make risky investments? I mean, shouldn't the insurance industry be the last bastion of stinginess of people who are not anxious to put their dollars in something that's as risky, like the banks did with some private loans?
Representative Winkler?
This is the level of my fiscal management background, so I'm just asking a layman's question.
Madam Chair, I know, Representative Gardner, I think you were directing to the testifier, but I'd like to take a shot. I mean, the point is, if you want capital to be invested in a certain area, you have to ask the people who have the capital to do it. And in this, I think 2 years ago I had three bills. One was the Angel Investor Tax Credit. One was to ask the State Board of Investment to invest in Minnesota companies in their risk portfolio, and the third was this one. So the point is the same. If you have people with capital or entities with capital, you have to ask them to put it in the right place. I think the previous discussion on the bill indicated that, in fact, there is some protection, and there's already regulation for where insurance companies can invest. And finding good venture capital deals out on the marketplace and having an incentive to look for them is what this bill is all about. It's about giving people an incentive to look for deals that are out there.
Representative Gardner. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's easy when I throw around insurance premium money. I mean, this is just general fund money, basically. It comes from whatever sources. I mean, we're just dedicating a revenue stream, but it's streams that would otherwise come into the general fund. And when we talk about venture capitals, it's capitalists and the people who are going to put the money in, they kind of don't have a face either. And I don't know a whole lot about this area of investment, but I'm learning. And my understanding is that to be qualified to invest in something this high risk, you have to have at least $1 million. Is that correct? Or there's some very high financial thresholds to be able to participate in a venture fund or an angel investment fund or a particular venture fund? Is that correct?
Representative Winkler,
I'm sure, yes. You have to be a qualified investor. And which is a federal definition.
Mr. Michael can define it exactly if you'd like.
That'd be helpful.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think the structure, what you're talking about is the typical accredited investor that's allowed under SEC rules to invest without in non-registered securities. But really what's going on here is there's a separate sort of company that's set up that does the investment, and most of this money isn't, as the testimony has indicated, is really coming from the insurance company into this fund, and so you don't really have these high net worth individuals that are putting monies into these Capco funds. It's mainly the insurance company funds that are flowing in. And of course, as has been indicated, the insurance companies get out of it the tax credit and then some other cash flow that the Capco provides to them to provide the return. Well, so you really typically don't have these, in this structure, have these high net worth individuals involved.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, thank you. But I tend to think that the companies that they're going to invest in will have venture capital funds as their primary source of income or investments. And so, but maybe I'm wrong about that, because if these are high-risk businesses that are just starting out, that have a new product that hasn't yet been tested, isn't that sort of the high-risk definition? Is it's going to have to come up with money from somewhere, and this will just provide part of that somewhere from us foregoing the insurance premium tax, and so that provides another source of venture capital to this business that one assumes has accumulated other money from other people who are willing to take a high-risk investment. Is that correct?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, typically that company has probably burned through their angel investor dollars, or they may have some amount left, and they've had some traction in the marketplace to show that there is a market for whatever product that they have. But in order, for example, to make it all the way through FDA testing or to identify channels partners for sales nationwide or something like that, they need some bigger pool of money to make it to the next stage. So typically, yes, you would have angel investors who have been in the company already, have some equity share, and then after that, and usually the company is out looking for venture capital dollars because they have used up their available sources and they're looking for the next big leap to make it through. Or they could be making money and they are limping along, but they can't get the kind of big venture capital investment they need to make the next big kind of stage up. And so there are existing dollars in there, but they're probably not going to be ongoing investments. I mean, and then furthermore, those earlier investors are likely to be highly diluted by the venture capital firm.
Representative Loeffler, then Downey.
And Madam Chair, so then I'm going to, as I understand it, if I were someone who had a great idea, and I'd gone past friends and family, and I'd gone past angel investors who had to be qualified to be able to take that risk, and I'm still not able to go to market because, you know, even though I've blown through a whole bunch of money, I'm still not there. This bill says instead of the company dying and everybody going home sad, instead the government's going to come in through the Capco stream and on the white horse and say, hey, wait a minute, here's some extra money, let's give you another chance. But even if you win, the profits go to those early investors and not to the state who came in on the white horse. Is that right? Other than, in theory, the company will still stay in Minnesota and it will still do something for the Minnesota economy. But there's no guarantee that they even will stay here long term. They could sell themselves out to a San Francisco-based company or something else. Is that a correct set of scenarios?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I don't think that's quite correct. First of all, they've probably used up their angel dollars in developing their product or developing their market or whatever it is up to a certain point. In order to continue or to expand and make the next leap, they need venture dollars. What we're talking about in this bill is whether or not there is a capital market out there for enough of those deals in Minnesota of a certain size. It's not whether the government's going to come in and save a company, which I would think is bad policy. It's whether or not there is sufficient capital in the market in this area, this size, these types of businesses, to support the continued expansion or the ongoing operations of a business like that. And what the government is doing is creating an incentive in the capital market to be more active in this particular space. And I believe the justification is because Minnesota does poorly in that particular capital market space.
Okay, Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, thank you, and I wish we could spend another hearing on this and actually whiteboard the actual flow of capital in the real market, because I think the question about the mechanics of this bill and then the question of how venture capital firms operate and the number of portfolios that they have and how they try to manage their risk by investing in a portfolio themselves, this concept that government is investing in businesses is just not even close to the truth here. And it's a great discussion because we're talking about displacement and opportunity costs, and I think those concepts apply equally to our bonding bill and other capital projects, to investments that the state makes. So this is actually, I think, a great discussion, and the idea of measures and those kinds of things are all positive. So it'd be, in my mind, it'd be great if we could spend more time. But let me just ask one simple question of Representative Winkler. Is there any scenario, any provision in this bill where the state of Minnesota would actually write a check to any Capco, any venture capitalist, any business. My understanding is this is a non-refundable tax credit. Is there any scenario where the state of Minnesota would write a check to somebody as part of this bill?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, the easy answer for me would be to say no, of course not. But I think that misses the point, which is that you are asking other people to write a check to do that. You're asking the government to write a check indirectly to create an incentive. And they're creating incentive by writing this check. And the question is, when the government steps in and steps into the market, or for any number of reasons, because people need to be educated to be productive, or because we need infrastructure to move goods and services, or because a civic center in a small town can mark that place for economic success, the question is always the same that you just raised, which is opportunity cost and displacement and other things. Are you getting more for the dollars that you're putting into it than you would otherwise? And it's the same test has to be applied to Capco. I believe this is better because it's the government incenting a market to move in a certain direction rather than writing checks itself. But it's still coming from real people to do it.
And they're going to kick us out. We appreciate your honesty there. It is about choices, but all the choices cost money. We're all going to go home and read The Wealth of Nations, okay? So with that, we're adjourned.